Hello, I'm Mark Tiley, and a warm welcome to another podcast at manxradio.com.
Mark Tiley, the nation's station, Manx Radio.
My guest this week on MyTunes has been part of the Manx Radio family for a long time, for a very long time. John Moss, when did you start with this little outfit?
1978, Mark.
78's a record speed, not a year.
Yeah, it's a coincidence. Yes. Indeed. I think they probably still were playing. No, they weren't playing 78. We had 33s and 45s, not 78. Yeah, no, I just started from doing down at the rugby club. I'd finished a game of rugby and the chairman suggested someone needed to be doing a report on the rugby to Manx Radio, and everyone else hid behind their beers, as they would. And I thought, well, I'll give that a go. And I did it. I wrote out a report, phoned it in up to Douglas Head, and I got a buzz out of it, a real charge. And I thought, I'm enjoying this. So I went on doing it for a few more weeks, and then I sort of suggested I might come up the Head and do it live. And after that, I was just beating on the door saying, let me in, I'm enjoying this broadcast. I'd never even thought of it. I'd done insurance, I'd worked in the Philatelic Bureau in the post office, but I'd never thought of doing anything to do with radio. But it's only when I started doing it that I got that buzz that I actually said, yes, this is what I want.
And over those years, not all at Manx Radio, because you did pop over to the BBC for a while, didn't you?
Yeah, I wanted to know what the BBC was like. I worked for Manx Radio for 3 years to 81. Then I went across to one of the best radio stations, local radio stations, I think, in the UK, Radio Hallam in Sheffield. It had everything going on there. It had murders, mayhem, fires, top football clubs, top managers. You know, the likes of Jackie Charlton and Billy Bremner and people like that. And for 3 years, and the miners' strike, Scargill, all sorts of personalities. But after 3 years, there was an opportunity to go and work for the BBC, which I thought, well, I'd like just to see what it's like working at the BBC. So I applied and went eventually down to Bristol. Actually, the chap who got the job initially in the first interview was Jonathan Pearce, who does football commentaries. But he turned it down eventually after he was given it and went to another station. And they rang me up and said, the job is now available again. Would you like it? I said, yes, indeed. I felt guilty about leaving Radio Hallam. The news editor I got on very well with looked at me as if I'd done something awful. And I felt so guilty. But by that time, I'd signed the dotted line and was on my way south. And it was an experience.
The transfer fee had been offered up and away you went. Was Keith Skews around in Hallam in those
cardboard
days?
Cardboard shoes, yes.
Cardboard shoes.
He was on air. And various other people's. Johnny Moran, who was one of the first BBC One newsreaders. Ray Stewart, who used to do the lunchtime programme. We had engineers who used to basically do things to the desk if they thought the DJ was up to it that would really throw a normal person.
Oh, do tell.
Oh, yes, one or two things. Like, I remember we had a DJ in the morning and he put on a long record so that he could go. Basically, it was a long show, so he had to go and do things. Anyway, the engineer, Lindsay, played a snatch of the record and then repeated it over the speakers again and again, which sounded exactly, we're playing records, as if the record was stuck. And I remember the programme controller bursting out of a room saying, can you hear that? Can you hear that? And the DJ, yes! Yeah, and was hobbling down the corridor, pulling his trousers back up again because he'd be caught, whatever you call it.
Let's make this right. So this was what they were hearing in the building. The listener...
Only heard in the building. The listener...
Was fine.
When the presenter got there, everything was fine. The record had been playing perfectly normally. It was just Lindsay, the engineer, got a snatch of record, put it over the speakers and repeated it.
Brilliant. Brilliant.
And it was very funny for us who found out afterwards. Initially, we just thought that the record was sticking. But when we found out afterwards, and they'd do things like turn the faders back the wrong way around so the DJ would come in. Or alternatively, Ray Stewart, he came back from, he used to sort of sojourn to the pub at lunchtime and he'd turn up about
during the
seconds.
Show? No,
just before. And they did it so that he came in with the first record, introduced it, slammed it in, and a completely different record came in. And it was only about the third record that Ray realised that they'd actually switched it so it was with another studio.
Oh,
and they were playing different records to the ones he introduced.
Brilliant. Brilliant days. Oh, this is going to be a fun week. Now, I've looked at the record choices, diverse as you would expect from a man with the amazing brain of John Moss, who can be two people at one time, Johnny Moss sometimes, John Moss another time. Tell me about Slade.
Well, Slade is a great way to start a show. I mean, they've got an advert on at the moment where you just see the back of Noddy Holder, but you know instantly who he is. It was raw pop, absolutely banging out of the speakers from the opening chords. Wham, bam, thank you, ma'am. And thank you, Noddy, as well, Noddy Holder. When I worked in insurance, about the only thing I felt comfortable with, not insurance, I can tell you, was doing the office functions. I collected the 45s and played the records. I sort of played at being a DJ. And that was a great record to get them on the floor. Noddy Holder, Jim Lee also wrote that record, I think, as well. He always seems to have a smile on his face, Noddy, when you see him. I know he's been quite ill of recent years, but even so, he just looks cheerful all the time. And I know he retired from live performance, and as far as I know, he exists off royalties, which is very nice. And he certainly got a lot of royalties, particularly that Christmas record.
Oh, yeah, huge.
Which they were originally a skinhead group, of course.
Yes.
And had no hair, but that didn't seem to do the trick from Wolverhampton. And so they decided to become glam rock instead. And so Slade said Merry Christmas, everybody, and collected the royalties. They've been doing it ever since. Always a very cheerful group.
So the track we're going to start the week with,
Come On, Feel the Noise.
Baby, baby, baby!
John Moss is my MyTunes guest this week. Actually, the way it started yesterday, I really should have allocated about 6 weeks, I think, because there's so many good stories in this man. John Moss, welcome again to MyTunes. Thanks for doing this.
Lovely to be here.
No, yeah, thanks for doing it. We're actually recording in the studio where, because this is the recorded piece, where John becomes Johnny Moss every TT. You're actually sitting in the very place where normally you'd be talking about revving bikes and all stuff.
In the chair, trying to get the excitement over and trying to do it in a way which bikers will appreciate.
Yep.
It's not too serious. Obviously, there are serious moments in the TT, etc., and you have to deal with them accordingly. But generally, you have to make it exciting. And also, well, you can, quite amusing.
Well, you do that brilliantly. You let us know you started in 1978. An amazing time to join a radio station. All the old equipment, the record players, the tape recorders, the cartridge machines, all of that.
Oh, it was to start off with, when we were doing programs with David Cobbler's Colister, you had things like that. I don't know what the engineers were playing at, actually, but they used to give you sat in a studio, David was in the other studio, looked at each other through a screen, and they gave you tape recorders, but they weren't in front of you, they were behind you. So to start a tape going, we had tape in those days, which you had to edit and slice and came very good at, you had to lean behind you and actually walk along with your fingers and find the right button and press it. And just when I'd got that okay, they put a new tape recorder in which had record buttons on it. And of course, there was an added hazard. You could press a record button, and it used to mean that the sound came out wah, 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 like
yes.
this, terrible. And afterwards, you felt so, even after doing a half-hour programme, it could drain you. You had a headache. You think, ah. And when you drove downtown, if you'd made a mistake on air, you thought everybody was pointing at you and saying, look, there's the chap who's just messed up on air.
Yeah.
It felt terrible. When I first came into radio, the first time I went on air, it was with a lovely bloke called Nick Corkle. And he'd been doing it for 3 years. And as he opened the microphone, I thought, what happens if no sound comes out of my mouth? I've never done live broadcasts before. I thought, well, Nick's been doing it for 3 years. He'll be okay. And I looked at him as the microphone opened, and I noticed his hands began shaking. And he was so nervous. He was always nervous. And it got to the stage where I looked at him. I thought, oh, my goodness, I might have to save him, not me. But I said to myself, if I'm after 6 months, I'm still that nervous, I'm going to give this up, because it can't be good for your health if you go on air and become that wrapped up in it. It's not good.
You were fine. You were absolutely
well. I grew into it, and now in the latter years, like you know about this, if something goes wrong, it goes wrong.
Just
it's like Terry Wogan. We don't do it as well as Terry Wogan,
no.
But sometimes his mistakes, you thought he put them in himself because he got out of them so
exactly.
well.
Exactly. Tomorrow, I want to talk about live outside broadcasts, because for many, many years, and for all our listeners, you've been the voice of some incredible events, coverage that you've brought us, royal coverage. Sad, happy, all sorts of events. I'm going to talk about those tomorrow. But I must say that when my dear friend here, John Moss, decided to go over to New York to see what was going to be Paul Simon's pretty much final live concert, when he went over to
Madison Square Garden,
I thought this man will definitely bring in a piece of Simon and Garfunkel into my tunes.
There are the obvious ones, obviously. I mean, with Simon and Garfunkel, I've seen Simon and Garfunkel in Hyde Park. The amazing thing was there was about 20,000 people inside the barricades listening to them. There's about 10,000 people camped outside the walls, but they could hear the music. And looking around, although these people were, say, 30, 35, 40, they were all singing the songs of Simon and Garfunkel, which at that stage had been going for a long, long time. I mean, I could have picked The Boxer, which in my view is one of the best records ever written, Bridge Over Troubled Water, which was absolutely extraordinary. I went to see The Graduate with my sister, and that has a Simon and Garfunkel soundtrack. I went to see it 2 weeks later, still nothing, but suddenly it was like a light bulb moment. Suddenly a light bulb was switched on, and I suddenly thought, this is absolutely amazing. So I bought all her LPs off her.
Of your sister?
Of my sister. And after that, everything that Paul Simon produced and Simon Garfunkel produced, I used to play. The record I've chosen is called Dangling Conversation. It's extraordinary. What's it about? A couple drawing apart, finding less in common, perhaps? you read your Emily Dickinson and I'm Robert Frost, or perhaps a couple in acceptance of their relationship as the years pass. But whatever you say about Paul Simon's lyrics, they're always interesting. It's like, "Hello, darkness, my old friend, the beginning of Sounds of Silence." That's because he used to go, when he was very young, in his teens, into the bathroom, turn the light off and play his guitar. And that's where, "Hello, darkness, my old friend," he's once again communing with his guitar. But his lyrics are brilliant. They're not just the straight, you know, "I love you, you love me," or "you don't love me and I don't love you," etc. They're different and they cover all sorts of subjects.
And this song first appeared where?
Parsley, Sage, Rosemary and Thyme LP, I think, okay. Which had the sort of flowery, fairly countrified thing, but still very lyrical and beautiful melodies.
It's a still life watercolour of a now late afternoon, as the sun shines through the curtain lace and shadows wash the room. And we sit and drink our coffee, couched in our indifference like shells upon the shore. You can hear the ocean roar in the dangling conversation and the superficial sighs, the borders of our lives. And you read your Emily Dickinson and I my Robert Frost, and we note our place with bookmarkers that measure what we've lost. Like a poem poorly written, we are verses out of rhythm, couplets out of rhyme, in syncopated time. And the dangling conversation and the superficial sighs are the borders of our lives. Yes, we speak of things that matter with words that must be said. Can analysis be worthwhile? Is the theater really dead? And how the room is softly faded, and I only kiss your shadow. I cannot feel your hand. You're a stranger now unto me, lost in the dangling conversation and the superficial sighs in the borders of our lives.
Yesterday, I teased ahead to the fact, the undeniable truth, that John Moss has been the voice of an awful lot of events coverage here in the Isle of Man and around the world. But John, thank you first of all for all of those momentous times where you've been not just Tymal Day, which I adore. I mean, I can't wait for your Tymal Day coverage. I sort of build up to it emotionally because I know it's going to be an exciting ride. And not just the hat coverage, but everything else that goes with it. But over the years, can you bring me a few moments where you really thought, my gosh, this is a bit special?
I suppose when you first start off Tymal, you get a bit nervous, obviously, because it's a big occasion. What I don't want to do is tread on people's toes. By that, I mean speak when they start speaking. So you have to be very conscious of what they're doing and when they're about to do it, etc. Tymal, after a while, you begin to go in the flow of it. You know what's going to happen next. You have the big occasions when the Queen is there, obviously, Prince Charles is there, etc., as King Charles as he is now, etc. So it is a big occasion. You try and, where you can, put a little bit of a chuckle in, where you can. For instance, we had a very tall governor, etc., who used to sit in the middle of the Tymbald Hill, etc., and he was surrounded by the House of Keys. I used to say that he is a very tall man. But I can't forget. I've forgotten his name now. But you can't see the governor for the Keys.
Oh,
you can't see
yes.
that the Wood Governor Wood. That's right.
Oh, that works better.
Yeah.
Yes.
You can't see the Wood for the Keys.
Yeah.
So you put that odd bit in. You have to keep straight faced as well, because a lot of people, obviously, for this is a very important occasion, etc. But at the same time, you've got the buzz of the what's going on behind you. You've got what's going on in front of you, and you're always thinking. And perhaps something will happen this year, like, I don't know, what? There was an occasion when Prince Charles was here, and he said something, well, we could hear, but the crowds couldn't hear over the loudspeakers, because around the corner came about 17, 18 of these petitions for redress of grievance. And Prince Charles, as he was then, leaned over to his ADC and said, the people are revolting. That's this great... A phalanx of petitioners arrived at the hill, but no one else could hear it apart from we could hear it over the headphones.
Just over the mic.
But it was you could see that he was taking it quite lightly as well, without being too serious.
I think one of the finest parts of your skill set is to tell people quite straightforwardly what's happening, what you're seeing, and giving it to us through your eyes. And there was one moment when we had dreadful snow and you were up at St Mark's and you couldn't drive in, so you walked in to work for the early morning recording your journey.
Not all of it.
Well, pretty a lot of it. Did you wake up thinking, this is what I'll do?
I woke up thinking that it has snowed, it's going to snow, and I'm ready to walk in. So that's why I set my alarm for about 4 o'clock in the morning. And then I had the kit, jumped into it, and set off. And then just, I took my tape recorder and my haversack, and as I was just going past this little bit between St Mark's and the Braid, where there's a stream, and you could hear the trickle of the stream, and all the time you're surrounded by this deadened effect of the snow, which is extraordinary, absolutely unique. So I thought, I'll record this. This is quite interesting. So I scrumped through the snow, the slight sound of this trickle, and I was talking to an audience and describing what it was. And I played it later in the programme when I got in, and it was towards the end of the programme. It was only a few minutes. But the reception and the response I got was amazing, because I think a lot of people thought, oh, I could have done that. Quite interestingly, when I drove away from that, I came away and all the side of the road was littered with cars which had been deposited by their owners and they'd sort of taken off. And I was listening to a certain radio station across, I must admit, coming back. And they started playing the 1812 Overture. And I thought, this is just like Napoleon retreating from Moscow. All the abandoned paraphernalia around me.
Stunning. Stunning. It was an amazing piece of radio. Loads more to talk about tomorrow. But Joni Mitchell, well, you and I share a passion for her music, her just amazing songs.
Amazing voice.
Amazing voice. So talk me through your Joni Mitchell choice.
Canadian, of course, she is. A Free Man in Paris, which is not about Joni Mitchell, although she speaks as if it is. It's about a bloke called David Geffen, who was her agent. She had a very close relationship with him. In fact, they lived together platonically for a while. It was reflecting his chance to escape from it all, to go to Paris, from the demands of his job, which were enormous, because, of course, the phone was constantly going, constant phone calls, pressures from the record label, amongst others, and the hit-maker machinery behind the popular song. It was always the pressure to get another song, another popular song, another hit released. The track was on the Court and Spark album. Mitchell played it before release to Bob Dylan, interestingly, and she says he fell asleep during it. Now, that might just have been an affectation. He might have been, as Bob Dylan does occasionally, trying to make a point. It had a wonderful hook, incidentally. Tom Scott's flute is the way, and it's when you start, you can always know where it's coming from. It's like certain records, they start, like Baker Street and things like that. That's it. As soon as it comes in, you know what it is. And the chorus behind, incidentally, you may not know, is Dave Crosby and Graham Nash. And when you listen to the chorus, you can make out, yes, that is them, isn't
well,
it?
I will focus on this, and I can't wait. Here we go. Day 3, Joni Mitchell, Free Man in Paris.
Somebody calling you down. I do my best and I do They're trying to be a good friend of mine. I was a free man in Paris. I felt unfettered and alive. There was nobody calling me up for favors and no one's future to decide. You know I go back there tomorrow, but for the work I've taken on, stoking the star maker machinery behind the popular song.
John Moss's long and glittering and wonderful career, which is far from over, by the way, there were moments when you went away to report back for us. I remember when, I think it was our fire service, donated fire engines to, Romania, and you went over.
Oh, it was wonderful. I went into the producer's office. Were you there? And I said, do you want to go to Romania?
And I thought, I think I had something to do with this.
Extraordinary. Three fire engines. The thing is with our fire engines, because the island is quite small, they don't cover an awful lot of distance. So when they come to the time when they should retire, they've actually got an awful lot of life still left in them. So I don't know how they did it, but they looked around. And in Romania, there was a place in the north of Romania, just by the border there with Hungary. There was a city and right next to it, a village. And what they did is take three fire engines. Two of them went to Oradea, which is the city. And the other one went to the village. Now, I was sort of dispatched to the village. We had certain people who were sent to the city, and one of them got on so well with the locals. He's a lovely bloke. They were almost going to build a statue to him at the end when he left. But we went to this little village, which was interesting because half the population were Romanian. The other were Roma, which we would know as travelling people these days, used to be known as gypsies, etc. And there was very definitely hostility between the two. But actually seeing this community, split community, living together was extraordinary. Also, we were given quarters. It was basically offices which had these steel bunks put in them. I was in with a lovely bloke from the fire service, but unfortunately he snored for Britain. And my aim was to get to sleep as quickly as possible before the snoring started. I wasn't very successful. I don't know, I think I snore a bit, but this chap really was Olympic class. I mean, the bed shook and all that sort of thing, the walls rattled and stuff like that.
Now, again, it was one of those fine examples when you managed to give us the sights, the sounds and everything of where you were with those fire engines and the crews. It was just that amazing, amazing piece of broadcasting. All those highlights, I mean, royal visits, you've covered quite a few of those.
Robert, I'll tell you one thing. You hear voices over there and you recognise them as one. My first year I was broadcasting, the phone went on a Sunday evening. I was doing a live film music programme And it was only about half an hour to go, and the phone went, and I picked it up and said, "Hello, Max Reid." And a woman said, "Hello, can I speak to Charles Gard?" I said, "Well, he's not here on a Sunday, etc. Can I help you?" And there was a pause. She said, "Well, it's Petula Clark here." And it was that moment when suddenly you hear the voice, you think, "Oh, my goodness, it is Petula Clark." Charles Gard had written to her. We had a thing called Seaside Special over here, and she was due to come over. And he said, "Can we talk to you when you're over?" And she came over, and she took the trouble of sitting in the Golf Links Hotel, which was occupied in those days by people living there, or staying there, and said, "Can I speak to Charles Gard?" And I would have loved to go down and interview the lady, but I couldn't because I had half an hour to go before our programme. So I rung around quickly as I could and got Barbara O'Hanlon, I think, to go down, who did an excellent job. But you thought, what a missed opportunity. Another one was when Nick Keg was going across the Atlantic solo. And I covered him all the way across. Not many people in the newsroom were that interested, but I covered him all the way across, all the way across. And he got there and he finished second to Tom Weld, I think it was. Yeah. And I thought, well, I want to interview him when he comes on. So I'll rush home, get something to eat, come back again with a bunk, with a with something to sleep on. And I'm going, and I came back again half an hour later. And good old Colin Brown said, "Oh, John, you're back. Nick's rung. I've done the interview." And you think, oh, no, goodness, because Nick, as soon as he got ashore after this solo epic trip across the Atlantic, first thought was, let's get in touch with Mike's radio and do an interview. Bless him. But unfortunately, he did it too quickly and I missed the opportunity.
You missed it. This next track, incidentally, dear listener, there's a bonus track on the podcast. So when this comes out a little later, the podcast, there's more. But let's go to have a chat about Leonard Cohen.
Extraordinary man. I saw him in concert in Leeds 2 years before he died. One great thing was, two things. A, he threw himself down his knees and bounced up again. He was 80 at the time. It was really enthusiastic. But also one thing that really impressed me was he was surrounded by these wonderful musicians. But when they were playing solos, etc., or he wasn't singing, he'd step quietly a couple of paces to one side, take his hat off, and just stand there listening to them, appreciating them, the majesty of their playing. And I thought a lot of people would have just gone off stage and done something else. He actually stood there and listened and looked as if he was really appreciating the music. I thought, that was brilliant. Mm. His lyrics, of course, are absolutely extraordinary, even more extraordinary than Paul Simon's. This one is about the condemned Joan of Arc talking to the fire that is about to consume her. It's written by Leonard Cohen. It's a duet with Jennifer Warnes. Now, Leonard Cohen was acquired taste. I think we have to say that. One of his lyrics was, "I had to sing, I had no choice. I was born with a gift of a golden voice." And that's greeted with ironic cheers from the audience because his voice was a bit gravelly. When he wasn't singing, he was doing this, appreciating the music going around him. And his backing group, I mean, the Webb sisters, the two Webb sisters sang there. They filled stadium by themselves without having to back another singer, but they chose to go on the tours with him and sing, and they were absolutely wonderful. All the singers were. His lyrics, things like, "Everybody knows you've been faithful, everybody knows you've been true, everybody knows that you've been faithful, ah, give or take a night or two. Everybody knows you've been discreet. There were so many people you just had to meet without your clothes." And of course, "Hallelujah," which had about 68 verses and has a deeper meaning. But Cohen's lyrics, you can buy books of his poetry and enjoy the poetry without the music.
So the final track in this regular course of events from Leonard Cohen is going to be Joan of Arc. More in the podcast, but for now, John Moss, thank you.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure. Thank you, Mark.
Now the flames, they follow Joan of Arc as she came riding through the dark. No moon to keep her armor bright, no man to get her through this very smoky night. She said, "I'm tired of the war. I want the kind of work I had before. A wedding dress or something white to wear upon my..." my swollen appetite. La la la, la la la, la 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 la, la 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 la. La 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 la. Well, I'm glad to hear you talk this way. You know, I've watched you riding every day. Something in me yearns to win such a cold and lonesome heroine. And who are you? She sternly spoke to the one beneath the smoke. Why, I'm fire, he replied, and I love your solitude, I love your pride. La la la, la la la, la 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 la. La 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 la. La 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 la. Then fire, make your body cold. I'm gonna give you mine to hold. Saying this, she climbed inside to be his one, to be his only bride. And deep into his fiery heart, he took the dust of Joan of Arc. And high above the wedding guests, he hung the ashes of her wedding dress. La la la, la la la, la 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 la, la la la. Fiery heart, he took the dust of Joan of Arc, and then she clearly understood if he was fire, oh, then she must be wood. I saw her wince, I saw her cry, I saw the glory in her eye. Myself, I long for love and light, but must it come so cruel and oh so bright? La la la, la la la, la 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 la, la 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 la, la 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 la.
Thank you so much for coming back for the podcast, the Leonard Cohen track, Joan of Arc. Extraordinary lyrics.
Yeah, extraordinary.
What an idea. How would you think of writing a song of a woman burning to death, talking to the fire?
Talking to the fire. And seemingly have reached some sort of agreement with the fire. She accepts what's happening to her, and the fire speaks back in the same vein to
Just bizarre. Anyway, dear listener, boys and girls, we've got him for a bit more. Too good to let him slip away. John Moss is my Tunes guest all this week. You very kindly lent me a book about John Lennon, which I found fascinating because I was a Beatles fan from the get-go, like you, the Beatles. And there were things in that book about John Lennon I had no idea. Mm. And quite a lot of it, and let's be quite frank, didn't paint him as a thoroughly decent bloke.
Well, he was a tough act at times. I saw him I saw someone playing Lennon in The Crucible. It was called Lennon in Sheffield. And the thuggish aspect was rather played upon. Now, in this book you mentioned by Ray Kelman, quotes from someone Lennon went to school with, Michael Isaacson, and I quote here, "I think if he had not become successful, he may well have become more than just a wayward bum. He might have become a really nasty piece of work. It's all hypothetic, but I believe the worst could have happened. If he hadn't become famous, his anger could have been vented in another direction. Where his energy was channeled into creative music, it would have gone into something destructive instead of creative. He was strictly an all-or-nothing kind of guy." There are some people that I've met in the world that you feel these are what I would call talented thugs. They're people, if they hadn't been directed into whatever they were doing, sport quite often, then they could have gone in another direction and used that energy, undoubted energy, in a destructive sort of way.
What amazed me about looking back at the Beatles at their most prolific period is just how many incredible songs they produced in such a relatively short space of time.
It was interesting, the relationship between McCartney and Lennon. They basically, as you discover in this book, went their own ways, even when they were writing songs together. It's Lennon and McCartney, McCartney and Lennon, etc. But, I mean, you can tell who actually wrote the song because they actually sing it, generally. But they sat together and did it and worked out and altered things on occasion. But generally, it was two individuals drawn together, producing basically individual songs, but labelled as a duo.
Before we go any further with the Beatles, can I take you back to Paul Simon and Madison Square Garden? Because I remember an interview, sadly not with me, when he was saying that actually he did regret not singing Bridge Over Troubled Water because he left it pretty much entirely to Art Garfunkel.
Yeah, we've always got this, but it was done. I mean, Art Garfunkel Paul Simon described Art Garfunkel as having a musical instrument, another musical instrument at your command. And the voice that Arthur Garfunkel offered on that occasion was perfect for the occasion. And when they come in at the end, "Sail On Silver Girl," that was referring to a girlfriend that Paul Simon had who had a silver streak in her hair, by the way. So there's all bits and pieces written into there. But yeah, we've always had this a bit of animosity between the two. And I suppose Paul Simon sitting there thinking, I wish I could have led on this because it's probably my masterpiece.
Yeah.
But then again, for many people, the masterpiece is the fact that the two voices came together and the music came together. Quite interesting with The Boxer, incidentally. There's a line in it where, just to come on from the whores on 7th Avenue, where apparently Paul, he stopped in mid-song once doing a concert. He said this woman approached him and said she sung it to her kids, but she changed it to "just to come on from the toy stores on 7th Avenue so that she could get away with that bit.
Love
it. There was an ironic cheer in the concert when they sing that line, because in New York, of course, it's quite close to 7th Avenue.
Yeah, yeah. Back to the Beatles and our final podcast bonus. You've chosen Penny Lane.
Classic pop music. When I was at school, King Bill's, just down there, we used to fly across and play rugby, and we went to Liverpool College, I remember. Not just me, there was a team with me as well. And I remember on a particular occasion, we had a great year, and we actually, I think we were undefeated that year, but it's all started that magic started going when we were at Liverpool. We were nil. I think we were drawn until about a few minutes before the end, and suddenly everything broke loose. But later years, when I was in Liverpool, I walked around Liverpool College and went around the bottom. It was only then I realised that it was in fact Penny Lane that ran along the bottom of Liverpool College. And suddenly a road which you wouldn't have paid much attention to suddenly becomes much more important. And you walk down it and you're looking out for the bank and you're looking out for this and you're looking out for that mentioned in the song. But the beginning, again, the beginning really hooks you straight off. The first Penny Lane, etc., and the barber, etc., like that. It hooks you. And it is a classic 2.5 minute piece of classic popular music, as it was in those days.
And it's perfect in every minute detail. John Moss, thank you again. Have a great TT sat there. Will you be Johnny Moss sat there?
Yes, I've decided when it rains, I might be Johnny Moist. I might bring that in as well. There may be people who say, oh, but then again, that's what TT Radio is all about.
I'm looking forward to it already. I'll bring my own galoshes. John Moss, it's been wonderful. Thank you.